although it is hard to address this topic in such a short time, I hope to at least give you something to think about. A valuable life lesson is that, if we have realistic expectations, we will not be disappointed. In a given field of study, well-informed expectations lead us to ask insightful questions. Yet unrealistic or misguided expectations only lead to disappointment. Let's pause and ask ourselves, what are my expectations for proving and explaining the human soul? Do I expect to form a clear and distinct idea of it, as I might have of a triangle or a square? Do I expect it to be something that can be imagined, like a semi-transparent ghost? A frequent pitfall in the search for truth is that our expectations predetermine our answers. As Sartre wrote, our choice of whom we should seek advice from may determine the response that we will get. He gives the example of a youth who was uncertain whether he should join the resistance against the Nazis. If he already knows that one counselor will encourage him to join, while another will not, his choice effectively predetermines the advice he will receive. Likewise, when wondering about the soul, one has some premonition of the kind of answer one is more likely to get from a scientist as opposed to a poet. It is not easy to have an open mind regarding the soul's existence, since people tend to have strong feelings either way. In particular, some scientists consider the soul to be a mere mental construct that has been disproven by what we allegedly now know about the human brain and its functioning. Yet, I'd like to suggest that it is neither the poet's nor the scientist's task to examine competing claims on the soul. Rather, the question properly falls under philosophy. While philosophy can help us examine whether each of us has a soul, we must be willing to think in ways that are unfamiliar. We may even need to be willing to reconsider our expectations of what constitutes demonstrative knowledge. As we will see, Aristotle would fully agree with materialistic scientists that what they envision the soul to be, namely some kind of ghostly substance, does not exist in the body. Yet that is not what the soul is in the Aristotelian tradition. Here's what I propose to cover in this talk. First, we'll consider the different types of cognitive expectations that one has when studying in three different fields, namely experimental science, literature, and philosophy. This will help make clear why experimental science can neither prove nor disprove the soul's existence. In the talk's second part, we'll consider two common philosophical answers to the question of the relation between the soul and the body, namely materialism and dualism. Then we'll look at the less familiar account of the soul found in Aristotle. Now, Aristotle lived in the 4th century BC, and Thomas Aquinas, perhaps Aristotle's greatest follower, died over 700 years ago. Nevertheless, I will endeavor to show you that their account of the soul turns out to be surprisingly contemporary if properly understood. Please note that I am not giving this talk in a vacuum, but rather in the context of recent lectures on this topic available on the Thomistic Institute website. Since these lectures do such a fine job of presenting the Aristotelian Thomistic account of the soul in an age of neuroscience, the first half of this paper is dedicated to situating philosophy itself, in particular for those less familiar with it. Only then do we address the three answers to the mind-body problem provided by materialism, dualism, and Aristotelianism. Say one enrolls in a course on chemistry. What does one expect to hear during one's lectures? Or to speak more philosophically, what are the characteristics of the subject matter of a given mathematical experimental science? What are one's expectations regarding the kind of knowledge one is sure to encounter? First of all, one expects to hear about observable phenomena. Observable includes all the sensible qualities of what one is studying, what we can see, hear, touch, taste, or smell. More precisely, science studies what is empirical. In a class on zoology, one would learn about animals one can directly experience. Frequently, scientists employ instruments as one observes cells that are not visible to the naked eye, for example. Second, and related to the first, one expects what is presented to be picturable in some way. For example, one can examine a drawing of the human skeleton, then use this diagram to identify its various parts. Third, the subject matter of modern science includes what is measurable, either directly or indirectly. A measurement is the assigning of a number to something not patently numbered in nature. While we can feel that a room is warm, we need an instrument and a unit of measurement to affirm that the ambient temperature is precisely, say, 72.4 degrees Fahrenheit. This leads us to the next characteristic of how modern scientific theories are conceived. One must use quantifiable terms if at all possible. In ordinary language, one says that a test tube feels cold, but for purposes of an experiment, one must quantify that experience. The more pure modern science is, the more it concerns itself almost exclusively with quantifiable data, as in the realm of quantum physics. That which is quantifiable is, by its very nature, calculable. Once one has the required numbers, one can use mathematical formulas to calculate the precise answer, an answer that is, as Descartes would have said, clear and distinct. We can see the continuity among these expectations. The last two expectations of pure science recapitulate the previous ones. We expect modern science to present its findings, if possible, in a model. The best scientific models unite the prior characteristics as much as is feasible by bringing out key features of some reality. Models are especially important in the atomic or subatomic realm, where one cannot directly picture what one is studying. Still, physicists can employ a model that represents at least some of an object's important features, as in the Bohr or the quantum models of the atom. Science thus allows one to demonstrate what is the case based on empirical or instrumental observation and mathematics. Thus, we expect science to present modelable and demonstrable findings. So you have all those listed on your handout. A final expectation addresses not pure science, but how it can be applied. There is a virtuous cycle between the physical sciences and technological progress, as each helps the other to improve. The positive feedback loop between pure and applied science is especially evident in the present day, which has witnessed more scientific progress than ever before. To summarize, we now have seven expectations for what science studies. We expect its findings to be observable, picturable, measurable, quantifiable, modelable, demonstrable, and pragmatically applicable. These are well-informed cognitive expectations for studying science. Say now that one enrolls in a course on literature. Our cognitive expectations here are almost entirely opposite. Indeed, why bring in literature at all in a talk on science and the soul? It is mainly in an effort to be inclusive of our different kinds of cognition. Not everyone listening may have a scientific or philosophical background. We must distinguish literary from philosophical discourse because some who reject the soul appeal to science and dismiss philosophy as if it were merely a form of literature. Indeed, Plato gave some grounds for this charge since, unlike Aristotle, he sometimes presented his ideas in a literary form. The contrasts and comparisons between literature and empirical science are worth reflecting on. In literature, the dependence on that which is quantifiable is absent. The realistic element of literature presents events that are part of ordinary experience. It thus deals with what is experiential or sensible, here meaning able to be sensed. While the fantastic element of literature departs from experience, it still presents what one could imagine happening. In the words of mythologist Carl Carigny, and this is text one on the handout, the stuff of mythology is composed of something greater than the storyteller, but always as something visible, perceptible, or at least capable of being expressed in images, and never as the Godhead in abstracto, or even as the Godhead in concreto, if the latter is to be regarded as unimaginable. Mythology must transcend the individual and must exercise over human beings a power that seizes the soul and fills it with images. Carigny's comments on God apply, mutatis mutandis, to the soul as well. For example, in the Aeneid, Aeneas speaks of his father's ghostly soul in Hades. So in the Aeneid, the soul is presented as a ghost. So if you can't imagine it, you don't talk about it in literature. This is not so. Thus, we expect literature to describe things, including the soul, in a way that is imaginable. This is not so for empirical science. The contrast becomes even starker when one considers that literature often uses figurative language. Poems, novels, and plays may employ figures of speech, such as metaphor or hyperbole. Even those most inclined to literalism can see that a metaphor such as "my wind cooling my broth" does not refer to actual wind, but to blowing on one's soup. By means of figurative language, literature, along with other fine arts, seeks to be evocative. Good literature does not leave the reader cold, but evokes emotions and has a quality of pathos. Where scientists may find that their methods lead them away from thinking about the soul, great authors such as Virgil or Shakespeare presupposed that humans have a soul. Such literature can serve as a preliminary education or propedeutic to the philosophy of the soul. Human consciousness is a reality that is central to poetry. It would be hard, perhaps even impossible, to write poetry from a purely mechanistic viewpoint, since machines do not experience emotions. For now, I state this based on experience. Literary classics also evoke considerations about the deeper significance of life. In this respect, literature is similar to philosophy, which inquires about the nature and purpose of things. As Aristotle said, quote, "the philosopher is also a lover of myths." When being assigned a play or a novel, one expects to be presented with a narrative that is somehow relatable. In contrast to reading a physics or chemistry textbook, one expects great literature to be relevant to one's life experience as a feeling, choosing human being. So the historical and concrete details seem irrelevant. While we have nothing at stake in who won the Trojan War, we can relate to the sentiments expressed. A work such as the Iliad portrays the human condition in its flawed nobility and predictable tragedy, in its all-too-human quality. In this respect, literature is trans-historical. As Carigny observed, it transcends the individual. If these expectations are fulfilled, literature can even be cathartic. Catharsis means purification in Greek. Aristotle showed that tragedy is cathartic because it purifies one's soul from negative emotions by allowing one to experience them vicariously. In particular, tragedy purifies the soul from anger and fear by evoking pity. Literature may move one's soul in the sense of one's emotions, yet it is not the task of literature as such to prove whether the soul exists or what the soul is. This is because literature can only use the limited tools at its disposal. These tools, such as narrative and metaphor, are valuable for ends other than those sought by speculative philosophy. Neither can experimental science, as such, directly address the question of the soul. To see why this is so, let us examine the cognitive expectations one should have when reading Aristotelian philosophy. We will see that almost none of the cognitive expectations appropriate to science or literature properly apply to Aristotle's study of the soul. Aristotle gives some indication of what our expectations should be at the beginning of his book on the soul. This is text 2 on the handout. I suggest you read it. Aristotle's very difficult. To attain any conviction concerning the soul is in every way one of the most difficult things. For although the inquiry here is common to that in many other areas of knowledge, I mean the inquiry into the essence and the whatness of the subject matter, one might think that there is some one method applicable to every subject whose essence we wish to know. If there is not some single common method of coming to know the whatness of things, the matter becomes even more difficult. For we shall then have to determine the proper method for each case. Here, Aristotle teaches that the question of the soul's nature is one of the most difficult that one could ask. Every area of knowledge seeks to understand what some thing or phenomenon is. One might therefore think that there is only one valid scientific method. Yet Aristotle argues that this is not the case. Rather, for Aristotle, any demonstrative inquiry regarding what is universally necessary qualifies as a science. Thus, pure math and sciences, applied math and sciences, and philosophy all fall under the aegis of science, properly speaking. Since there are many scientific ways to know what things are, the matter becomes even more difficult. This is because one must then distinguish different ways of knowing different kinds of truths. Hence, we must adjust our cognitive expectations when we approach Aristotelian philosophy from those that are appropriate for other areas of knowledge. Our cognitive expectations for literature will not be fulfilled by reading Aristotle's book on the soul, at least not by reading it as he intended us to do so. Those who think that the word soul only refers to some ghostly substance will find that he does not consider the soul to be an imaginable entity. Figurative speech and relatable evocative narratives may prepare one for understanding the soul, that is, they may play a propedeutic role, yet they are of no use in a demonstrative proof of the soul's existence or a proper definition of its nature. In these respects, the philosophical proof of the soul is similar to modern scientific proofs. This is no coincidence. In his logical works, Aristotle helped lay a foundation for both empirical science and philosophy by distinguishing demonstrative proofs from poetic and rhetorical discourse. Aristotle uses demonstrative proofs to establish the soul's nature and faculties. On the other hand, in contrast to one's expectations for mathematical and experimental science, the soul is neither sensible nor empirically observable, whether directly or instrumentally. Although one can observe and measure the soul's effects, one can neither observe nor depict the soul itself. The soul as such is not picturable, measurable, or quantifiable. Calculation and instruments are of no immediate use in coming to understand it. Nor does knowledge of the soul have any direct, pragmatic, or efficient application. Thus, the only criteria that it shares with the objects of science are the use of demonstration and of models. Yet the list of characteristics begins to show the difference in the basis of such demonstrations and models. For example, they are not based on mathematics. If all of this is so, then one may begin to wonder how one could understand the soul. Paradoxically, this is a good place to start. Why? Because one cannot put knowledge in a mind that already has it. If we think we already know precisely what something is, then we may find it difficult to view it differently. The main outcome of this talk thus far is the following. To expect a philosopher to provide a mathematical and experimental proof of the soul's existence is like expecting to do lab work in a literature class, or expecting to read poetry in a chemistry class. The mathematical empirical method can neither prove nor disprove the soul's existence. The vital principle of living things falls outside the scope of the modern scientific method. As for literature, its goal is not to demonstrate to begin with. So we should not expect a poet to be able to demonstrate the soul's existence. The soul's nature is the object of philosophical rather than of literary or mathematical experimental study. So if neither the experimental method nor literature as such can prove anything directly about the soul's nature, how can one even approach the topic? For Aristotle, one can know the soul by beginning with one's own experience as a living human being, especially one's conscious operations such as sensation, thought, and emotion. Philosophy deals with what we can demonstrate and understand based on an analysis of our direct experience of ourselves and of the world around us. Accurate cognitive expectations for studying the soul are that it be conceivable, demonstrable, understandable, and definable. This study is based on ordinary experience, that is, experience that is unmediated by scientific instruments. It uses causal analysis independently of mathematical measurements. I'll return to this later when I give more details about Aristotle's account. While demonstrable is an expectation for both experimental science and Aristotelian psychology, as you can see on the list, it applies differently in each case. Where experimental science demonstrates regarding particular causes and processes and relies on precise measurements, philosophy demonstrates regarding the most universal and fundamental causes, such as the soul and body in general. In general here means as both common to and differentiated in all living things according to their distinctive kinds of acts. Aristotle adopts a strictly demonstrative methodology. One must first prove that something exists before one can ask what it is. The ancient Greeks conceived of the soul as the primary cause, that is, the principle of life. Everything that is alive has a soul, and nothing that lacks a soul is alive. We still speak this way in English, as revealed by the etymology of terms such as inanimate and animate, from the Latin animata, meaning ensouled. Of course, the etymology alone is not a demonstration, but it helps us to begin to conceive of the soul, at least with an initial nominal definition. Aristotle demonstrates the soul's existence as follows. There must be some explanation for why living and non-living things are so different from each other. That is, there must be some cause for this. Whatever this cause is, this is what we initially call the soul. Having established that there is some vital principle called a soul, one then uses living things' unique characteristics to show the soul's distinctive nature. Just because all living things have a soul does not entail that every living thing has an incorruptible soul. For Aristotle, plants have a nutritive soul. Animals have a sensory soul. Humans have a rational soul. Only the human soul is immortal. Before going further into the substance of Aristotle's psychology, it's important to consider the two competing accounts of the soul that preceded his. So this is part two. The first answer to the question of how the soul and body are related is dualism. This holds that soul and body are two different things. One finds a classic expression of dualism in Plato, who writes the following. And this is text 3. Socrates uses speech and talking, but the user and the thing he uses are different. For instance, a shoemaker uses a round tool and a square one, and others when he cuts. The cutter and user is quite different from what he uses in cutting, so the user and what he uses are always two different things. Now a human uses his whole body, and we said that the user and what he uses are different. So a human is different from his own body. Then what is a human? He is the user of the body, and the user of it must be the soul. But since neither the body nor the combination of the two is a human, we are reduced, I suppose, to this. Either a human is nothing at all, or something he turns out to be nothing other than a soul. According to Plato, I am not really my body. Rather, I am a soul using a body. Body and soul are two different things, with the one controlling the other. My soul is me, my body is not me. Plato here presents instrumentalist dualism. The soul uses the body as a shoemaker uses an awl, or as a harpist plays a harp. On this account, I am one soul speaking by means of a bodily instrument, two other souls who are now hearing me by means of their bodily instruments. One hears the opposed materialist answer to the soul-body problem from the first philosophers, those prior to Socrates. A pre-Socratic, such as Heraclitus, reduced the soul to being a physical thing that is part of the body, namely the element of fire. Thus, prior to Aristotle, we have two opposed opinions. Either the soul is some physical part of the body, or it is a spirit separate from the body. Note that both dualists and materialists consider the soul to be some kind of thing. In the modern period, one observes the same opposition between dualists and materialists or physicalists. Almost all early modern philosophers granted the soul's existence, yet almost all, following Descartes, conceived of it as a thinking thing separate from the body. Descartes replaced the living soul with a thinking mind. We thus have the modern dilemma of mind-body dualism. Descartes further updated Plato by portraying the mind as a spirit that controls the body, which is a machine. For Descartes, the mind is truly alive. However, the body only appears to be alive. In the same way, a ticking clock might appear to be alive. In Descartes' own words, this is text 4, the body of a living man differs from that of a dead man as much as a watch or other automaton, that is, other self-moving machine, when it is wound, differs from the same watch or other machine when it is broken. Descartes is very clear about his view. The body is not just like a machine, it is a machine. The human body is not ensouled. Rather, it is extrinsically connected to a mind or spirit. Only humans have minds or souls. Plants and animals are just machines. 20th century British philosopher Gilbert Ryle disparagingly referred to this as the ghost in the machine. Descartes' depiction of the soul as a spirit provided a convenient straw man for materialists to knock down. Shortly after Descartes, Thomas Hobbes said that it is incoherent to call the soul a spirit, for it is contradictory to speak of, quote, an incorporeal body, or, which is all one, an incorporeal substance, end quote. Yet this is a circular argument, for it begs the question by assuming what it should prove. That is, it presupposes that only bodies exist, then concludes that every substance must be bodily. This question-begging approach underlies much of the philosophizing that some contemporary scientists engage in. When Hobbes rejected the mind, he was left with nothing but a machine. Contemporary materialists continue the Hobbesian tradition of knocking down the straw man of the soul, portrayed as an immaterial substance separate from the body. Since we allegedly observe the body functioning purely as a machine, all we need to do is get rid of the superfluous thing called the mind or the soul. Here at Yale, Professor Shelley Kagan's thought-provoking course and book entitled Death is directly relevant to our topic. Although Kagan's clarity of expression is appreciated, followers of the Aristotelian tradition would disagree with many of his conclusions, and also with how he sets up the problem, because it's all physicalism versus dualism. Kagan writes, this is text 5, "There is no soul. We are just machines. Of course, we are not just any old machine. We are amazing machines. As a materialist, Kagan considers that the recent discoveries of neuroscience explain consciousness without the need for a soul. While we can agree that these discoveries are amazing, we need not agree that they disprove the soul. Kagan continues, "We are machines capable of loving, dreaming, being creative. Yet it is unclear how we can do these things that no machine can do. Are we to believe that the human capacity for self-determination, love, and creativity are nothing but byproducts of electrochemical processes?" Kagan concludes, "Death is not some big mystery that we can't get our heads about. Ultimately, death is no more mysterious than the fact that your lamp or your computer can break, or that any machine will eventually fail." One could hardly hope for a more direct statement of mechanistic physicalism. In this perspective, all one has to do to embrace physicalism is to exorcise the ghost of the soul from the body machine. So now we're going to go into the holomorphist answer, which is Aristotle. So if you think it's been difficult up to now, this is where it starts to get difficult. In contrast, Aristotle rejects both dualism and materialism. For Aristotle, the soul is neither a thing nor some ghostly substance. His solution to the soul-body problem is known as hylomorphism, which comes from the Greek hule, meaning matter, and morphe, meaning form. For Aristotle, the human person is only one thing, not two things. Let us hear his reply to Plato's dualism. This is text 6. "To say the soul gets angry is as if one were to say that the soul weaves or builds a house. Surely it would be better to say not that the soul pities or learns or thinks, but rather that a human does so by his soul." End quote. A human is one thing with two aspects. The soul is the formal aspect, and the body is the material aspect. We attribute some activities primarily to the body, others primarily to the soul. It would be strange to say that the soul builds a house, since one obviously does this by means of one's body. Likewise, it is not the soul alone that thinks or feels emotions, but rather the embodied soul or the ensouled body. The soul and the body are not separate or even distinct things. Rather, they are two principles that together constitute one thing. The body is the human person's material cause, while the soul is a living human's formal cause. The rational soul is the formal principle of a human being, while the organic body is the material principle. Thus, while one can picture the body, one cannot picture the soul in any way. For Aristotle, asking whether the soul and body are one would be like asking whether the candle wax and the candle shape are one. In his words, this is text 7, "One should not inquire whether the soul and the body are one or not, just as one should not ask whether the wax and its shape, or in general the matter of each thing and that of which it is the matter, are one or not." So another example he gives in his physics is the bronze and the statue. Do you ask whether the bronze and the form of the statue are one thing or not? "For although the terms one and being have many senses, the dominant sense is that of actuality. Liquid wax is in potency to receiving many forms, but once it has dried, it actually has only one form." So the wax is extremely important for understanding Aristotle's point. The wax example. "The soul and the organic body are not two things any more than the wax and its shape are two things. Rather, they are two causes of one thing. Soul and body are related not as two things or substances, but as form and matter. It's like the shape of the candle and the matter, which is the wax. It's the analogy. This account of the soul relies on analogical terms. That is, terms that have many senses depending on the context. Analogical does not here refer to figures of speech such as metaphor. Rather, analogical terms such as one, being, potency, and act are context-dependent terms that express the most fundamental aspects of reality. Words such as act and potency function in a proportional, hierarchical, and comparative way. And you have that on the list three of the distinctive characteristics of philosophical knowledge. They are said relative to each other, as in being awake as opposed to being asleep, or seeing as opposed to being able to see. Most likely, you are familiar with the distinction between potency and act in the case of potential versus kinetic energy. The potential refers to what something could do or be, as in the rock on top of the hill, while the actual refers to what something is doing or being, as in the rock rolling down the hill. Hence, Aristotle defines the soul as, and this is text 8, the first actuality of an organic body that has life and potency. This definition presents the relation between soul and body in terms of act and potency. Only an organic body is potentially alive. An acorn is potentially a living oak tree. Once the acorn is planted and given water, it becomes actually alive, as the plant's nutritive soul is elicited from the potentiality of the matter in the acorn. While only the human soul is incorruptible in its essence, every other living thing, from a bacterium to a gorilla, has a corruptible soul. For the sake of brevity, here is a demonstration in the form of a proof. 1. All living things are spontaneously self-developing, self-directing, and self-healing. 2. No machines are spontaneously self-developing, self-directing, or self-healing. 3. Therefore, no machines are alive. Thus, one Thomist defines life as, this is text 9, the natural capacity for self-perfective, immanent action. Only living things are capable of properly immanent, self-perfective activity. Non-living things do not perfect themselves in this way. Machines eventually break down and do not repair themselves, but need to be repaired by a human agent. In contrast, the living transcend the law of entropy by self-developing in a structural way. While we may speak of computer learning in a metaphorical sense, even the most sophisticated machine does not have the awareness of sensation that an insect has. When we say that our computer is asleep, this is only a metaphor. In contrast, true cognitive and appetitive consciousness are the highest modes of a living thing's self-perfection. However, when any living thing other than a human dies, that by which it is alive, namely its soul, is corrupted together with its body. One way to understand the truth of this is to consider a corpse. In terms of the matter, the corpse is identical to the previously living body. Yet something has changed. Therefore, there must be some cause whereby we explain this change. This is the soul. All the requisite organs and cells are initially present in a corpse. Yet they are no longer actualized by a vital principle. If one thinks of a human body without a soul, one is thinking of a corpse. And you can kind of see that Descartes reads that point in a different way. Aristotle argues that a lifeless corpse is a human body in name only. Thus, he compares a corpse's eye to an eye made of wood. Neither are truly or actually eyes. Here, a materialist might object that what differentiates the living body from the corpse is merely the presence or absence of chemical processes. The matter is the same, but the required processes have ceased functioning. One can reply that consciousness is not reducible to the electrochemical charges present in neurons. If consciousness were just such neuronal activity, then an individual neuron firing in a test tube must have a modicum of consciousness. Yet this is not so. If positive and negative electric transitions are what define life, then why limit life to apparently living beings? In virtue of the electricity present in any machine, we should call it alive as well. Kagan appeared to state as much when he compares humans to electric lamps. This is consistent with his materialism. For materialism denies any substantial difference, that is, a difference in kind, between the living and the non-living. Rather, it only admits of differences of degree between things. As is often the case, Kagan appeals to the degree of complexity. While Aristotle would agree that the body is extremely complex, he would consider that this complexity is not self-explanatory. For materialists, humans and machines are only called alive or dead by a difference of degree, that is, by a difference of purely material accidents. Substantially, humans and machines are equally alive or equally dead, since life is a mere surface phenomenon. There is no essential difference between a person dying and a lamp breaking. Since even the presence of electricity is not essential, though our being machines is essential, one could just as well compare death to a stapler ceasing to function. Though materialists such as Kagan ascribe consciousness to the so-called amazing human machine, they lack any principled account of why humans alone have such unique activities as self-determination, despite our being fundamentally and essentially identical to machines. Aristotle, in contrast, rejects materialism in favor of hylomorphism. The form determines the matter to be what it is, as in the form of the statue, determining the bronze to be the statue of whoever, Bucephalus. The soul as form of a given body determines that body to exist as a living body. Since humans are capable of self-movement and self-actualization, we are not mere machines, for Aristotle, but rather ensouled bodies. All living beings are capable not only of structuring themselves, but also of repairing themselves, while machines can perform neither of these functions independently, as I argued earlier. Let us close our presentation of hylomorphic psychology with some wisdom from the great medieval philosopher Thomas Aquinas. For Aquinas, all of us always already know that we have a soul. This is something that we cannot not know, for we know directly by perfect self-reflection that we are presently thinking. The obscurity enters in not with knowing that we are alive and animated, but with knowing what the soul is. As Aquinas says, the latter requires long study. And so this is text 10 from Aquinas' Summa. Here's his argument. The intellect knows itself by its act. This happens in two ways. First, individually, as when Socrates or Plato perceives that he has an intellectual soul because he perceives that he understands. In the second place, universally, as when we consider the nature of the human mind based on the intellect's act. There is, however, a difference between these two kinds of knowledge. For in order to have the first knowledge of the mind, the very presence of the mind suffices. Since the mind is the principle of the act whereby the mind perceives itself. The principle is just the first cause. So the mind is the first cause of the act whereby it perceives itself. So this is self-reflection. and hence it is said to know itself by its own presence. Presential and reflexive knowledge are the same thing. But as regards the second kind of knowledge of the mind, the mere presence of the mind does not suffice, but rather there is required a diligent and subtle inquiry. Hence, many are ignorant of the soul's nature, and many, too, have been mistaken about it. Whether we are engaged in understanding literature, science, or philosophy, we know experientially that we have a soul because we know that we are self-aware. That is, we understand that we understand. Thus, even the staunchest materialists realize by inner experience that they have a soul, even though they do not acknowledge it. They realize de facto that, unlike mere machines, they have self-consciousness. Machines may break, but they do not feel pain or despair when they break, nor angst about their inevitable breaking. Machines don't compose poetry about what it is like to be doomed to break. Neuroscience does nothing to prove the contrary. Rather, Aristotle provides the tools to move from the fact that we have a soul to the reasoned fact. His view that the soul cannot function without the body during the present life is thus in harmony with neuroscience. Neuroscience studies the bodily mechanisms that underlie consciousness, but philosophical psychology studies the formal principle responsible for consciousness. In the final analysis, it seems best to end our considerations where we began. One's choice of a counselor may pre-establish the advice one receives. In terms of agency theory, such choices effectively exclude one or more branches of the relevant decision tree. Likewise, our turning to literature, experimental science, or a particular philosophy may be predetermined by the kinds of answers we are predisposed to accept. A sign of an open-minded choice is one's willingness to engage contrary arguments. While holomorphists are familiar with materialists' arguments, the same is not always true for materialists regarding holomorphism. Granted, it is more difficult to understand holomorphism than the clear results of a scientific experiment. Yet, if neuroscience, under the aegis of methodological naturalism, is our only option regarding the soul, then we may have predetermined the results before we have begun. It is puzzling that Kagan's book neither mentions nor refutes holomorphism. Thus, the book limits the conversation by its choice of interlocutor. Against dualism, some of Kagan's reasoning is compelling. Kagan writes, "All the evidence for the soul just doesn't add up to a very convincing case." Yet, he does not address holomorphism. Holomorphic psychology is challenging because the human mind is naturally geared toward the knowledge of physical things and mathematical ideas, or things that we can imagine, rather than philosophical principles. To think in terms of analogical causes, rather than concrete things or scary ghosts, can be daunting. Still, the Aristotelian Thomistic position deserves a serious hearing. Neuroscience does not disprove the soul as Aristotle understood it.
We have time for a few questions.
Thank you very much for your talk. I have a question about some of the analogies you mentioned for holomorphism. You mentioned, for example, a candle and its wax, a statue and the bronze that it's made out of. Aren't those weak analogies, though, because it's assuming that we're dealing with a material object, which is not the case with certain kinds of souls or spirits, right? Like angels and demons, according to Aquinas, don't have bodies, they don't have matter.
Right.
The same with the Holy Spirit. So how could hylomorphism have any truth to it if one believes in other kinds of spirits like angels and the Holy Spirit?
Right. So with Plato, that the soul is immortal is easy because there's a separate soul, so it's a pure spirit. So with Plato, immortality is easy. With Aristotle, everything has a soul. Most souls die with the body. So with Aristotle, the question is, on how is there a soul that's immortal? So it's the opposite. And so the thing is, that's why I said analogical terms are proportional. So it's about the relationship between potency and act. It's about the change from a state of potency to act. That's why I talked about kinetic and potential energy, which most people are familiar with. So there's a change of state from potential to kinetic energy. And that's why Thomas, whenever he talks about form and matter, and Aristotle as well, it really is about potency and act. That's why it's defined as the first act. But we used to think potential and kinetic energy, the kinetic energy is a state of movement. So one has to think about act not as a state of movement, but as a state of being.
So an angel then would be...
So God, Aristotle, Aquinas defines, refers to God as a form, and he refers to angels as forms. They're self-subsistent forms, because form just means act. God is the only pure act. So act is eventually what leads us to talk about God in a meaningful way. But also, so the soul and God are both, Aristotle talks about both of them in terms of act.
Thank you. Huh?
Yes. Do you focus any of your work or scholarship on... any indigenous frameworks of soul and body and like dualism with that? Or do you engage in
non-ancient
philosophers in your work?
I mean, I work on every kind of philosopher, but I mean, modern, contemporary, but I mean, that as far as indigenous, that's more like, I would put that more on the level of literature, which can be valuable as a propedeutic because they have a sense of the soul. I don't think there's ever been an indigenous people that were atheists, because atheism is the fruit of Western philosophy. So they have myths about the soul. Remember, Aristotle said the philosopher is a lover of myths. So that's where I would bring that in as the propedeutic. And so in that sense, it's helpful because they have a willingness to talk about the soul that materialist scientists, you know, don't have.
Do you know of any indigenous theologians currently doing work?
Well, I'm a philosopher, so...
Philosophers, indigenous philosophers?
For me, what matters is the truth, so I really don't care who says it, whether they're Greek, whether they're German, whether they're African. I read anyone. A lot of what I work on is Arabic philosophy, so Avicenna, Averroes, Thomas read them. They were Muslim. Thomas didn't care. He just read them because they were... They had helpful things to say. So a lot of my work is on those guys, the medieval Islamic philosophers. So, yeah.
Back there.
So I know one form of thinking about the mind is, with the materialist perspective, is that the mind is kind of just a computing machine, takes an input and performs some computation and our actions on the output. And I'm thinking, like, the difference... I'm trying to understand the difference between really what makes a soul versus what makes a machine. And you mentioned stuff about writing poetry, loving, interacting like that. And, I mean, I know there's advances with computers in the way that you send it lots of data and it's able to perform some learning tasks that you didn't expect out of a computer. If one day it got to the point where computers could write poetry, for example... How would you make the distinction between that and a human soul?
So, I mean, the difference has to do with consciousness. So, I mean, we'll say the camera sees, but the camera isn't aware of that. So consciousness is what's key. That's why I said even an insect, on some level, is aware that it sees. But maybe a computer camera that can see much better than a human eye, that can see all kinds of details, that can see an ultraviolet, that can see... But the point is, it's not aware of that. We have to look at it, and then we are aware of it. And perhaps someone could write a computer program eventually that could write poetry. But the point is, that's just an extension of the human intellect. So computers don't have awareness. What was interesting to me, I met a computer programmer once. I was prepared to debate artificial intelligence. He's this very good computer programmer. And he just said, oh, you don't need to debate with me. He said, I know my machine does. I know my computer doesn't think. Because he's the one writing the program. So it doesn't give the illusion of thought. Wittgenstein is good on this. He talks about conceptual confusion and being beguiled by language. So that's why I talked about when the computer goes asleep, that's a metaphor. But we tend to be beguiled by language, right? We speak of machines so much as if they were alive that we start to think of them as alive. The more profound philosophical point is that for materialists, they are alive just as much as anything else. And they're dead just as much as anything else. For the materialist, in a sense, either everything is alive or everything is dead.
Yeah, this idea that Kagan has of the machine. A machine is something mechanical, something material. It's a means for doing something. Instead of washing clothes by hand, you make a washing machine. So isn't that really a misappropriation of the meaning of the word itself to describe the mind as a machine or to describe us as a machine?
Yeah,
isn't that just nonsense?
I think that's a good point, yeah. I mean, that's what I was arguing, but based on the principled account in terms of causal analysis, in terms of act and potency, the kind of actuality that we have, as opposed to...
Many of these modern arguments are just a misappropriation of language.
Right, that's Wittgenstein's point.
The corruption of man is followed by the corruption of language. So if you want man to be a material being, you corrupt the language and call him a machine.
Right.
It's not sophisticated.
So when we talk about artificial intelligence, I would say that's just a metaphor. There's no actual intelligence. So when the human plays chess against the computer, the computer is functioning as an extension of all those programmers who worked on it. But the chess player has a consciousness of playing chess. The computer doesn't have consciousness of playing chess. And we observe that so in many, many different ways. But
for perhaps a final question...
Thanks for your talk. So I don't see usually this topic come up as particularly contentious, projection of the soul, among secular folks. But it usually is rejected as a standard for the rejection of the methods that we've just talked about. And yet there's this desire also to try to bring everything together, like ideas of unity of knowledge in all the fields. Why can't we get around this by trying to bring in unity of method? Why do we have this kind of knee-jerk reaction, in your opinion, to bringing together philosophy and empirical science?
Well, first of all, I think the soul is quite contentious because Professor Kagan teaches a class on that and started for many years. And the whole point of the class, as he states in the introduction, is to convince you. But the man on the street. So what we do in most cases, we rely on revelation. We have the benefit of revelation. And so we know because we're Christians or Muslims or Jewish or whatever, indigenous, basically most everyone accepts the soul. So that's the first point. But if you're just talking about the ordinary man, so the thing is, when you come up against people who are arguing against the soul, especially based on materialism, then that's where we need to be able to reply. And so that's why we have that reply. Now, as far as there being one method, we basically have, that stems from the modern philosophers. So basically Aristotle was very influential in the medieval period. And so there was an awareness of there being many different approaches to many different things, because Aristotle set that out in various writings of his. But then Descartes and the moderns, Descartes in particular just wanted to be kind of more one kind of knowledge that explains everything. And so that's where all the kind of different sciences and methods collapse into one. And that's where philosophy ceases to be a science. But one thing I put in there is that for Aristotle, for Thomas, philosophy is a science. A science is any demonstrative knowledge with necessary matter. Matter is what you're talking about. And that's universal in scope, and there's many other logical characteristics of it. So what happens is the moderns like Descartes want to kind of an after Descartes one, appropriate science, that the only thing that's scientific is modern science. And so that's what I was arguing against. Because Kagan is, I mean, it's on some level an enjoyable book. He's very kind of laid back about it. He grants a lot of things, and he's not polemical, so that's all nice. But in the background, there's definitely that idea that, you know, with science now, the soul is obsolete. So that makes a demand of us to kind of recover the philosophical science, at least for those of us who aren't just going to appeal to faith, which we could do. But in dialoguing with Kagan, if I say, oh, well, I know that there's a soul because the Bible tells me so, that's going to be rejected out of hand. Whereas nothing I said relied on faith in any way or revelation. So it's just based on experience and reasoning based on experience. So.